Welcome to Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and proud member of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined, as always, by your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. On this episode, we will discuss the numbers under the hood of some early season performances, whether analytics takes away from the enjoyment of the game, players including Tyler McGill, Nestor Cortes, Matt Brash, Kyle Tucker, Andrew Vaughn, and so many more. But before we get to all of that, Alexander, how you doing?
Matt, it is going well today. Good to hear from you.
Well, I'm glad to hear that things are going well. Do we have an update on the car situation?
No.
No? Still?
To the shop, it's
not
fine.
Good. That's the very short answer.
Yeah.
That's not going to be much of a discussion starter then.
Yeah, no, I dropped it off. Maybe it'll be fixed next week. I've learned a whole lot, I should say, about how to really efficiently take two buses and a train to work. I think that's the real update here.
I guess that's a silver lining, right? That's
Yeah. The trains have been a mess here in DC over the past, it's not a year yet, but it's been a long time since they've been quite right, because there's like some new ones that were out because their axles weren't working. I hear that's important for trains. They tell me it's important for trains, so they pulled all them, and they've just been using the old trains, which is like half of the ones they have, so the wait times have been terrible. But the good news is, if you take a bus to the train, you can get like an infinite number of buses that come by, and my wait times to transfer have been like nearly zero basically throughout. So I've managed to turn what was, if I take two trains to work and then a bus, an hour and a half, down to about an hour and 5 minutes. And I'm really proud of that. Yeah,
there you go. Well, that's there and back, right? So that's almost an hour a day.
Well,
that's fast math. No, because you do it differently coming home.
I take an Uber.
There you go. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm talking about.
I only know
I would do it.
I only trust the other people's insurance to reimburse me for one Uber a day, because, you know, the risk of paying $50 a day in Ubers is just too high for me to deal with. So I'm not doing that.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that situation resolves itself very, very soon for you. That is an annoying situation. So I want to start off today by talking about something that where the answer may seem obvious, given that the name of our podcast is Dugout Study Hall, and we're talking about metrics and math all the time. But I do think this is an important conversation to have, because it comes up every year and it comes up all the time, and different talking heads have very different points of view on this. So I'm going to ask you to answer this question, and then I'm going to ask you to answer it again, taking the other point of view. So you're going to have to kind of put on your old school high school debate cap here, where you have to be able to argue both for and against the thing that you truly believe in yourself. And that's about analytics' impact on the game itself and whether it makes it better. Did the analytics actually hurt the overall enjoyment, the on-field product? Maybe they help teams win more games, but does that help draw more fans in? So that's the question that we're going to start with. Do analytics take away from the enjoyment of the game, Alexander?
So I'm going to start with, I think, the best case for the point of view that I don't as strongly agree with, which is, I would note, definitely not the case that you're going to hear from a lot of stupid cranks online. So I'm going to do their job for them, and because they don't listen to this podcast, they won't regurgitate anything I say. I often think about what like some of the most influential pieces of media that I've consumed about baseball are, and I think like in the pantheon of like the top five is this podcast from the Ringer Baseball Show that came out last year, a couple weeks into, maybe like a month into the start of the season. And yeah, it's April 30th last year. It's called Pitchers Are Lapping Hitters. It's Time to Do Something. And they were basically making the argument that we've gotten so good at turning pitchers into superhuman weapons that can throw 95 mile an hour sliders that are impossible to hit, that the game of baseball is just less fun because nothing happens anymore. And I think that is an extremely convincing, well thought out, analytically minded argument about why analytics are bad. From like a aesthetic value based point of view. I do think that the most fun moments in baseball happen when there is a runner on second or third, and there are far fewer moments when a runner is on second or third, when the game is built to strike everybody out.
Right.
And I do think that things need be done to make strikeouts happen less often. Now, the problem, I think, with the people who make a similarly, like an argument against the same enemy, they're not making similar arguments, right? They're saying analytics bad, right? We need to get back to the good old days, something, something, Tony Gwynn, something, something, whatever. I don't know. I wasn't alive then. Is that, like, they basically say that, like, players just need to go the other way or whatever it is. Well, it ignores the fact that, one, pitchers are superhuman weapons and it's really hard to do that. And, like, two, the way the incentives work, as long as the game basically still, like, is using the same sorts of risk-reward systems, like, if you make it so that the ball is, like, de-juiced, like, that doesn't affect Joey Gallo as much as it affects DJ LeMahieu.
It
actually hurts the guys you want to exist more, and it encourages pitchers to continue to be that sort of, you can have some fly balls and some strikeouts and some walks, and I'm not going to let you have singles because I'm not pitching to contact in the middle of the zone. Like, that's the game that we're playing, right? If fly balls aren't as dangerous, you either need to be able to hit them 1,000 feet or not hit them at all. And 1,000 feet is much easier to produce talent wise. So, like, the argument there is that your team should still be doing it, but aesthetically, from art and enjoyment point of view, it's bad. And I think I'm comfortable having that conversation because I'm also comfortable saying, yeah, so we should have more runners on second base in extra innings because that makes baseball more fun. When you do that, you just get a whole lot of angry replies, and please send them to me. You're wrong. The runner on second rule rocks. The other argument, though, and I know it's central flaw. The argument that I actually believe is, like, analytics are good because winning baseball games is fun, and they help you win more baseball games. The problem with that, I will admit, is that, like, it also kind of assumes that, like, you don't ruin the aesthetics along the way because people are making choices that adjust in good faith. Like, you can do analytics and, like, walk and chew gum about baseball being fun and interesting, right? Solving problems by being smart doesn't stop happening. Like, if people hate the aesthetics, if you just have, like, a commissioner and rules committees who are able to kind of, like, trim things along to make things still be fun. Plenty of games get updated in real life all the time to, like, have balances and stuff like that. That is, like, the central feature of, like, online video games, is that, like, if there is, like, a certain part of the meta that is, like, too good and makes the game less fun, they change things. We do that in baseball all the time, by the way. Just, it's more on, like, a decades long scale than couple weeks long.
Move a little more at a glacial pace in baseball. I think it's one of the downsides of it being such a game steeped in tradition, is that's where it works against you, that people don't like change in baseball, but yet that change is what helps kind of find that normalization that responds to the adaptations, because actually, the change you're talking about is rules-based, but players are changing everything they do all the time. They're changing it in-game to be responsive to what the other team has changed to get them out a little bit more. And that's that cat-and-mouse thing that most people really enjoy. And then they don't like that idea when it comes to, like, the macro rules changes or banning shifts or whatever the case may be, the three true outcome situation. So let me ask you this. I'm going to take the same concept and ask you one more question about it. Did the analytics that got brought into New York ruin the New York Yankees?
Were they never not ruined?
Well, it depends upon which decade you're talking about.
The thing that ruined the Yankees is that they stopped spending $1 billion a year on their lineup and they let everyone catch up. That's what ruined the Yankees. I don't think that's, like, I don't think you can, like, argue against that in even an ounce of good faith. Like, that hasn't been the problem.
I'm going to try.
Okay.
Let's look at it this way. Why would they, and they've made some adjustments this year, which I acknowledge, bringing in guys like Gallo, but why would you build a team that is kind of antithetical to the strengths of your park if you're not just being swayed by the numbers on the page?
I think your argument gives away the fact that it's not correct when you say that the numbers should say, based on the dimensions of the park, that we should do something different. The Yankees are, I would say, pretty good at a lot of analytical-y things, especially the pitching side. Their pitching development is great. Their problem is that a guy named Hal Steinbrenner tells them to stop spending money, and that's basically it. Like, the reason that they have the team that they have constructed, they've traded for like so many of these players rather than signing them in free agency. They've been looking for values everywhere. Yeah. I think that there are two things we should separate when we say analytics, really. And there, on one side, there is let's do things to help us win more games. The other side is so that we don't have to spend money instead, right? The whole money ball, whatever, like, it's lack of money ball. It was kind of what it was born out of, right?
Yeah,
it's
sure.
John Fisher's and his family just have never wanted to spend a single dime on the A's, and have instead preferred to do anything else with their money. The Yankees caught wind of the fact that they could try to do that too, and so they're pocketing the hundreds of millions they make after they print like $600-700 million a year. They spend $200 million on payroll. They could comfortably spend $100 million more. That's it. There you go.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here. And by no means, you can send me the tweets if you want, but am I saying that the Yankees are a poorly run organization? I'm just trying to synthesize some of the things that I've been seeing other people talk about.
Yeah, I think there's actually been a good like number of things I've seen online or like, that the results on the field have set, like probably prompt us to want to talk about in this early season that do make some of these conversations more interesting. There's been offense down issues. The Yankees just dropped 2 of 3against the Orioles and like got shut out in one of those games against, I can't even remember who it was because it was someone so no-namey. Like, that's the whole point. Yeah. No, offense has been down. There's question marks about the ball again. I'd like some more data on that. Like, I'm not even willing to start running weird savant queries to like figure out if the offense is down because I want a few more days of stuff still. But like, it doesn't look great. And you know, like beyond that, a lot of the teams that have the crankiest fan bases are some of the teams that have kind of borne the brunt of that. So you're going to hear these questions again when that happens, and I think to answer them, you necessarily have to try to think these stuff matters. But
so if you've built a team based on the numbers that are three true outcome teams, and then the ball is what's the opposite of juiced? Are we saying de-juiced? Unjuiced?
Yeah, de-juiced.
Lack of juice.
Come on.
Yeah. I know that your point earlier, it was like that's not going to hurt the Joey Gallows as much as it's going to hurt the DJ LeMahieu's or the Kevin Biggio's of when he was good. Overall, like on a bell curve, you would think that even Joey Gallo is going to suffer somewhat. And if he suffers a little bit and Aaron Judge suffers a little bit and Stanton suffers a little bit, even though they hit the ball a ton and it's not huge, over the course of a season, that might have some impact. And then you look at all the other people who are on the team who are more greatly impacted by that. If you've built your team that way, as opposed to a team that might be able to put the ball in play and be a little bit more responsive and adaptive to a ball that's not going as far, is there anything in there? I'm just thinking of this on the fly, playing devil's advocate a little bit. Is it possible that actually hurts a power first team to the nth? Like the Yankees are like to the nth degree with that, right?
I should note, this is actually, I ran this the other day. I need to double check it, and I'm not going to do it while I'm sitting here in front of my computer, but I can later. This year's Yankees were on pace to have the second highest hard contact rate of any season in the StatCast era, which is obviously a bunch of nonsense because it had been like 8 games or whatever.
Yeah, you're right, like, sure.
Like, so like, who cares? But like, they are, and this is including strikeouts and walks and all that stuff, it's just how much on a pure PA basis that isn't just mash ball and three true outcomes. This is how much do we do it, period. They were hitting the ball hard more often than anyone else ever had, and the results just hadn't come because of some bad luck, but not even like bad base running luck. Like, seems like de-juice, but if everyone else is also playing with the same de-juice ball, if they're hitting it 15 feet beyond the fence instead of 50, it's still a home run. If the other people are hitting it into a glove instead of 5 feet beyond the fence, they're hurt more. Or, you know, you get more lazy fly balls that are easy to field if you're a contact-oriented team. I think the thing that we always freak out about with the Yankees is that if they haven't won all of their games, it's a crime. Whereas if anyone else has won just most of their games, it's a success. And that's what it's come down to.
Well, it could just be that there's much more attention on the New York Yankees than there are on other teams. But they do seem to be and have been kind of the poster franchise for this kind of prototype of player. So we don't have to belabor the point. I think we've talked about it.
I would prefer them if I want to like fit, if I want to like put a last stamp on the point. I would prefer the Yankees build to the insert any other team that hits the ball kind of hard and doesn't strike out a lot. I would prefer the way that they are running in a D-juice ball world because the power is not going to drop as much for them. The home run revolution of the past 10 years or whatever has mostly been dudes who can't hit the ball hard suddenly hitting home runs. So that's my dumb take. I'll call it dumb.
All right. Well, on that note, let's move into our number of the week segment. And for this episode, I am not going to give you a number, but rather ask you to talk about the metrics that make sense when we are trying to early in the season buy or sell players. And in this installment, we're going to focus specifically on pitchers, and we're going to talk about a handful of guys who have shown up and been very good so far. Obviously, a very small sample size. When you're talking about pitchers, it's even harder because they obviously only throw every 5 days or so. But if we're looking at people like Nestor Cortez, even, or Matt Brash, there was a little bit of hype in some places on some of these guys, maybe less so on others. But when we are looking at, is this somebody who's going to sustain? Is this somebody I should buy into? Is this somebody I should either pick up or trade for? What are those numbers under the hood that are going to help us make that decision about the legitimacy of what they're able to do?
So as of today, this is, again, Tuesday, so there's going to be a couple more people, whatever.
Yes.
162 baseball players have started a game, which sounds about right. Roughly five-ish, throwing a couple more times 30 teams. And I know this because I just pulled a Savant query for the number that I've been tracking with most interest to try to actually figure out if I should be in on a guy so far, which is, if you listen to our PitchCon episode, that whiffs per PA that I said was like the thing that I had found was most likely to tell you who's going to strike people out going forward within one or two starts. It's an imperfect test that I'd run them, but I've been curious and wanted to try it out in real life and see how that worked. I want to give you got some people. I said 162. So people who are in the top 32, the top 20% that were essentially afterthoughts at some point, you know, in your 12 team format, might have been on your bench or below, and 15 teams are guys that you were sort of interested in. So here are some guys. At 31, you have Kyle Wright. He's getting about 0.57 whiffs against the average batter. So that means, like, you know, you're gonna get a whiff every other batter. That doesn't seem like it's a whole lot. You don't strike that many people out. Good strikeout rate is like 25-30%. So if you can get a foul and some called strikes, being able to reliably get just one whiff against every other batter is pretty good. He's 31st. Other people who, as I'm going to keep taking up this list, Joe Ryan, who's looked really sharp so far, is at 0.65. He's in 23rd. Nestor Cortez is 18th, 0.68. Shane McClanahan, who has looked way better this year, just noting this is a tracking thing, 0.71. He's 14th. Hunter Green, looking excellent so far when he can like put a ball anywhere near the strike zone and it doesn't get hit into play. He's actually had some issues with that, but that's a whole other conversation. 0.71, 13th place. Ty Lord McGill is 11th on this list. And then you see all the like the usual suspects are actually good in between these. Andrew Heaney is 5th so far, and Jesus Luzardo is 2nd. There is no minimum pitch requirement. This is literally you in doubt, you tried. First was Taijuan Walker. He faced 9 batters. It's really funny to me. But like everyone else that I didn't include is like Kershaw, Rodon, Giolito in his very short start. Hope he's back and as good as he was. Alec Manoah is up there. Pablo Lopez, Corbin Burns, all of the people who've been good. Shohei Ohtani, right? These are all people who've been really excellent. They've been getting a lot of whiffs. Their results have been good. We would expect them to be good going forward. So a lot of these guys who've looked really good have been getting whiffs. That's really all it comes down to. I don't care about anything else all that much. I've tracked some of the other stuff to see if they've been bad, and we haven't noticed it, like hard contact stuff. But this is the one number that right now I even kind of care about for breakouts.
So just to clarify, Alexander, you're talking about whiffs per PA, not just a whiff percentage or a strikeout percentage. Is that correct?
Yeah. So let me like break those out a little bit here. So like whiff rate, whenever you just call something rate, I always get annoyed if it's like not clear. So I want to make sure I can like spell that out. Whiff rate typically is used to describe the percentage of swings that you produce that miss. So how often you whiff when you strike or when you swing, which is kind of a weird number because not all pitches induce swings as often as each other. Like if you're like throwing a changeup or a curveball, that's like always going to be in the dirt. Yeah, it's going to be hard to hit, but like probably a ball a lot too. So kind of like a good when it works, how does it work sort of number that I generally disregard other than kind of like for flavor and descriptiveness for people's stuff. If your whiff rate is really bad on a pitch, that's usually meaningful, but like not the other way around necessarily. Swinging strike rate is whiffs per pitch, which is generally pretty useful, but you get some sort of like noise from it. Basically, the people who pitch to contact won't have really high swinging strike rates, but like it breaks the model. Like if you like don't pitch to contact, then your swinging strike rates can often be a little bit higher because like people actually swing later on in counts, whereas they don't swing early in counts. So like it's a good-ish thing. I've just found that if you want to predict strikeouts, having the same denominator as strikeouts, plate appearances, tends to have a little bit less noise even than that. And just like those little tiny things you can do to get fair comparisons help. Swinging strike rate is not a terrible number to look at, but like it just has some reasons why it won't perfectly work. As a result, I tend to prefer whiffs per batter. Basically, the effect is if you're okay at getting swinging strikes, but like when you don't get a swinging strike, is it a ball or is it in play? That difference can really matter for how often you get strikeouts. And because like we're trying to predict strikeout rate, that's kind of where I'm going at. I will note this metric can be slightly biased in front of people like, let's say, Matt Brash, who, I kind of had a thing where he took a no hitter into the fifth, but like walked four batters and like,
it's not
the prettiest untouchable outing, but his stuff is nasty. And he's going to strike a lot of people out, which we care about in fantasy and does lead to more reliable results quicker. I care much more about taking chances on those guys early because we're going to have a better idea of whether or not their version of success is like who they are than the guys who like pitch more to contact, because we're not going to be able to know if they're like actually good at that skill for a lot longer. So here we are 3 weeks in the year. I do not really want to gamble on guys who rely on umpires or batters to do their job for them. I know what Matt Brash's path to victory looks like, and it does not involve either the umpire or the other batter helping them out or their defense helping them out all that much. It's just throw ball, person misses, onto the next one. And if they don't swing at all, it might be onto the next one the other way around.
Well, it's more controllable, right? That's
right.
They have they're in the driver's seat in terms of their ability to do that because of their stuff, rather than releasing the ball and then hoping for a good outcome because it was a called strike or the batter didn't do much with it.
Yeah, I should note I'm not pulling these as directly because I don't have like a stuff algorithm. But like the stuff plus numbers are really good on a lot of these guys too, and are also worth caring about. I just like to make sure that I have a check on that sort of stuff that's different, so that like I know how it works. This black box stats, I feel like, can be a little bit weird to explain to people. So I want like a more manual, even if I have to run a search through Savant, like I want a more manual stat that I can kind of reference back to that's outcomes based, just as like a you know, checking your work. I trust the people who run these stuff models. They're smart people.
Yeah. It makes sense. Okay. We have talked a little bit about looking at the metrics and kind of under the hood at what's been going on in these first few weeks to try and make sense of things, not just, hey, the results have been good, but why have the results been good? Or vice versa, I suppose, is fair. And I want to talk more about that with our central question, which is kind of geared around, like, what would be surprising or maybe not surprising if we were to come back on May 31st and look at what we're about to talk about, and what numbers kind of point us in that direction. So that's kind of what we're going to use for the crux of the episode. But before we get to that, we are going to take a very short break.
Hey, Alex Fast here, and thanks for listening to this podcast on the Pitcher List Podcast Network. If you're a fan, consider supporting all of us by getting a PL Plus subscription, where you're going to get an ad-free website and get access to our Discord, where you can talk to all of our podcast hosts and staff. Plus, you can hang out with our incredible Pitcher List community. It's basically a baseball sanctuary year-round for as low as $8 a month. You can sign up at pitcherlist.com/plus, and you're going to get your first month free with promo code podcast. Also, don't forget to check out everything else we do as well, from YouTube videos, live streams, newsletters, off-season articles, TikToks, breakdowns, over 15 baseball podcasts on our network. We can't stop talking about baseball, even during the off-season. So sign up for PL Plus today at pitcherlist.com/plus and use promo code podcast to get your first month free. All right, thanks for listening. Let's get back to the show.
And we are back. So, Alexander, we're going to try and do this, I guess, not really a game so much as just kind of a goofy premise. But based on what's happened already, let's look at some scenarios in terms of, like, would you be shocked if on May 31st, Andrew Vaughn is in the minor leagues, kind of a thing? And why? Why do we think that would be possibly be the case, or would it be absolutely shocking because of the numbers? So let's start with Andrew Vaughn. I think there's a lot we can say about him, so I'll let you start where you want to start with him.
I like that you really led with, like, the goofiest version of this, not like the Andrew Vaughn is batting second for the White Sox, which I think would be, like, what everyone wishes were the case.
Yeah,
and you just led with the other clickbait version of this. We're trying to generate, like, verbal clickbait here, because the bounds on these things, the most extreme-ish expectation or whatever, I think are the fun ways to analyze this. What's the ceiling or the floor is way more fun than what's the middle.
Right.
So with Andrew Vaughn, I like that we can leave with him also, because you can basically do all of these scenarios because of how completely disconnected reality has been from his playing time reality.
Right.
There's this guy named Tony La Russa involved, and I don't know if Andrew Vaughn, like, is being blackmailed by him or, like, owes him money or what the deal is, but the lack of consistent playing time for him. Sure, he's right-handed, which puts you on the small side of platoons if you're not playing full-time. His defense has not made him, a locked-in full-time player, but, like, come on.
Yeah.
I don't have a better way to say it than that, which is why I think we need to be able to, like, have some sort of, like, let's look at what's happened so far and be realistic about how good he's been and whether our frustration is realistic before we make some would it be crazy if sort of situations.
So let's look under the hood then. What are those numbers that would lead you to your conclusions? What are the things about what he's actually doing and controlling that would say, like, this is just lucky and he's had good output because the ball just happened to go where the defense wasn't, or what is it that he's doing that is very encouraging that this is sustainable and he absolutely is going to force his way into the lineup more, even if Tony La Russa wants to be stodgy and old and weird?
Well, I want to, before I say the really ridiculous thing here, just track some fun stuff about him, like, long term. We've brought him up a couple times because he's, like, one of my favorite. He adjusted, the numbers changed, look at rolling charts, guys. He started out with a high 20 strikeout rate and forces, like, rates into the, like, mid-teens for a strikeout rate, basically going from figuring out how to go from, like, a low minors to, like, no high minors to major league pitching successfully. Beautiful transition, absolutely kind of what you'd hope for from, like, a top three pick. The net result was a kind of average season, but, like, every possible thing that you could hope kind of like got figured out. I very much continue to believe in his potential. What's he doing this year? He's striking out 16% of the time. His 8% walk rate, like, is pretty good. Not great, but like, it's pretty good, I guess. So yeah, that stuff that's like stable quickly, great. Andrew Vaughn also has the second highest hard contact rate in baseball right now. He has hit the ball hard in 12 of his 25 plate appearances. That's insane. Wait, no. I don't know. Yeah, that's it. 12 of his 25 plate appearances.
Not sustainable, but a good sign.
the crime here is that it's been 25 plate appearances. But yeah, he's done everything you could ask of him to just an absurd, absurd degree. I looked this up this morning, so I knew that. I'm going to pull it up again because I wanted to see who was first. And because I will probably cite this again if we're realistic, but like, that's insane. Like, this guy was sitting in the low 30s, which is still good, last year. Like, he was legitimately effective and we would believe what he was doing. But yeah, you sit the minimum of 25 plate appearances, he's second behind, please load, Marcell Ozuna. Okay, an absolutely insane thing, third, Nick Madrigal. I have no explanation for that. I can't. I don't know what's happening there. But yeah, he has 16 hard hit batted balls.
The cautionary tale of small sample sizes right there. But
maybe it is.
That's okay.
I got to figure out what they're feeding Nick Madrigal, because that's really good. I would not expect that from him. But yeah, no, Vaughn is basically doing all the things we'd expect him to do, except play every day, which is what you would expect that a team that drafted him, believes in him, and promoted him quickly and wants to get production out of him would do. And instead,
So I had on here, like, would you be surprised if on May 31st, Vaughn is starting every day? No,
I'd be 0% shocked. I would be jokingly shocked because Tony La Russa is involved, but his play merits that. I wouldn't be shocked at all.
Yeah. And whether that's Tony La Russa coming around or somebody else calling the shots there, doesn't seem like it would be shocking. What about, seriously, the kind of jokey thing that I said, but Vaughn is in the minors?
I really doubt it, in that, like, I don't think they could reasonably do it. And also their way that they've messed with him doesn't seem to include that as a plan. They seem to think that he is a major league piece. Whatever
just
that means.
Need to play every day. Yeah. No, I would be very surprised if he was in the minors. I think he's here to stay. It's just very silly that he's not getting the playing time. Now, here's one that I think is very interesting. Would it surprise you if on May 31st, Vaughn has been traded away from the Chicago White Sox?
I would be shocked, but I'd be really happy. I think the White Sox are a great offensive environment for him. I just really want him to play every day, and I'm kind of annoyed enough with him that I would cheer for the move. Sorry, all of the White Sox fans that I follow on Twitter who are also really annoyed with this and don't want that to be the way this gets sorted out. I don't think it'll happen. That's why I said I'd be shocked. Like, what are you going to trade him for that would be a fair return?
There was something that was on, I think, MLB trade rumors not that long ago, maybe a little over a week ago, about the A's and some pitching. So I'll ask this question. It doesn't have to be a true, like, I don't want to get into speculation about trades. Like, that is what it is. But would Andrew Vaughn be more valuable on May 31st as a member of the Chicago White Sox or as a member of the Oakland Athletics?
In fantasy, I think this year he'd be more valuable if he was on the Oakland A's because he would be batting third.
Yeah.
That's
all about opportunity, though, not talent, right?
Yeah, exactly. It'd be a worse perk for him.
Right.
Like, for sure, you know.
That's why I was asking the question. It's kind of a worse situation and a better situation. So, interesting. Talk to me a little bit about Kyle Tucker. What would your expectations on May 31st? We're going to be talking about Kyle Tucker and looking back at the beginning of the year and saying, oh, that silly first 3 weeks. Or are we going to be saying, oh, that was the beginning. We should have known better.
I don't really think I've shifted my mental adjustment of Kyle Tucker for any reason, but I think other people have had some wild shifts in assessment on him for different reasons. So there was at first the, like, is he going to continue to bat sixth or seventh talk? And then for a minute there, it looked like he might be back second, which would really change his value. Like, for right. every move up the batting order, you add, I think it's something on the order of like 30 PAs. So like moving up from sixth to second would be a huge change. Like, we're talking like almost 100 more chances bat over the course of a year. Now, those are a little bit different for a team like Houston, which will actually get a good number of opportunities like per game for its lower in the order guys, relatively speaking. And we should also say this is all kind of Altuve just got hurt. That could change things, I guess, in mind. But like, I got some texts from friends who like are Astros fans who are like, hey, why does Nico Goodrum have us bat third in the order today? When at one point. And yeah, it's been crazy. So I can't say that there's a whole lot that necessarily makes sense on the choices slide. But Tucker is walking 14% of the time this year, which is deserved if you're as talented as him. He is leveraging his ability to figure out what's going on at the plate and drawing more walks. He's struck out 17% of the time so far. But again, these are all small numbers. Like, we're talking about, I gotta pull this, isn't be funny. How many walks is that? That is six. That is six walks.
Yeah. There you go.
And seven strikeouts. Still, if that even remotely keeps up, if he can stay above 10% this year, that'd be really cool for him and stay in the mid to upper teens, I guess, in strikeout rate. He was 16% last year, 17% this year, whatever. If he stays in those ranges, that'd be cool. The big number I want to note for you guys to not panic about his results, because like, he's batting 114 right now. Is that maybe what drew some of him into this conversation?
Yeah, I don't think his results have been very good. But again, very small sample size.
Yeah, he's got a 10% line drive rate. He's been hitting the ball into the air, but like too far into the air. He hasn't been getting any of those like bloop singles that help inflate your batting average.
But to your point, line drive percentage you've talked about many times, right, is one of those things that very often regresses to the mean. It's not necessarily a controllable thing. So if he's 17%, if I'm remembering what we've talked about before, 15 to 17% below average online drive rate, that's actually a good explanation for the outcomes with a prognosis of improvement, right?
Also, he's been really lucky in terms of people like catching balls into play, relatively speaking. I should give the caveat here. The difference between WOBA and ex-WOBA would not be as telling as it would be if there has been some ball dejuicement going on. That would mean that our understanding of ex-WOBA for balls put into play is assuming a better ball. That said, this is still a huge gap on a small number of balls in play. Chances are, like, he's hitting the ball hard-ish still. He's gonna be fine. Like, right now, he's got a 450 ex-WOBA and a 239 WOBA. He's got a 304 XBA and a 114 X average, and that's without line drives.
Like, yeah, right.
So there's multiple things that should swing back in his favor. The only thing that's not going to swing back in his favor, I'd expect, is Dusty Baker's lineup choices.
Yeah.
I think he continues to bat sixth for too long, just because I think that that's what Dusty's going to choose to do.
Although hitting what you say, 114, makes it a lot harder to push him to the top of that lineup. Maybe if he heats up a little bit, that decision becomes a little bit more difficult. Let's stick with our shtick here. Would you be more surprised on May 31st if Kyle Tucker is still struggling or if he is himself?
I would be shocked if his batting average at the end of May was below 250.
There you go. I like that you put a number on it. I should have done that. Well done. All right. Let's talk about players who are kind of doing well and how we can look under the hood there at those metrics to understand, is this a flash in the pan? Is this a true breakout or a performance improvement? And I'm going to ask you to look first at Connor Joe. What's going on there? And is it believable and sustainable, or is this just like a really nice start to the season?
So I want to start with a non-numbersy thing, which is that Connor Joe bats right-handed. And with right-handed hitters, you either expect him to play like every single day, maybe get pushed down the lineup, or like be a small side platoon mess of a commodity to roster. Connor Joe has been firmly in the good side of things for the Rockies, been playing all the time, batting high in the order, and it's really deserved. He's got a 1.109 OPS as of this morning. He's batting 359. That's good, I would say.
Yeah,
he got 47 PAs, I should also note. Yeah, the playing full time. Remember what I said about Vaughn having 25?
Right.
Connor Joe's hit about twice as often as he has so far this year. That's really important. Now, the Rockies make a lot of stupid choices. And just playing a lot and having to have a good average is not enough to make someone a good player. And I think that's the thing we're worried about. Exceptionally Stephen A. Smith voice, however, though, he's been really excellent in a deserved way. And I'm like very convinced that the little bit of Connor Joe we saw last year at age 29, his first full look in the majors, was an accurate look at who he is. And all of the Connor Joe's the best Rockies outfielder actually takes seemed like they're true. Striking out less than 20% of the time, walking double digits, that's good. Hitting the ball hard pretty often, that's good. Like, this is the recipe for a sustainable player that I would want to see. He's done some like really weird things in terms of how often he's hit the ball, like sweet spot slash line drivey being above average as well, which might be inflating some of like the average. But like, if that's a real skill, that'd be pretty cool too. If it regresses just a little bit, he's still got a lot of room for regression to still be just fine. I don't think he's going to be like a 30-20 or anything ridiculous. Don't ascribe too much here, but he looks like the sort of guy who's going to reliably rack up a lot of counting stats and that should be in your lineup a lot going forward based off of what is admittedly, like, let me do some math here. He has, over the past two seasons, 258 PAs. That's not a ton. But, you know, it looks like that if you're going to say something ridiculous like Connor Joe is the best Rockies hitter, I wouldn't be shocked at all if at the end of May that's the consensus.
Okay. What would be more surprising to you, that Connor Joe on May 31st is must roster? And give me a league size. Let's say 12 team.
Yeah, let's say like Yahoo 12, ESPN 10, like some pretty standard home league sort of stuff.
Okay, so that he is must roster or not so much waiver wire.
I think I'm going to go extreme on that. Like either like, I want to put some like outfield numbers on there. So an ESPN 10, that's 5 outfield. Yahoo 12, that's more teams and more util spots, but 3 outfield. So like we're talking like a top 50 outfielder. I think it would be far more shocking if he wasn't like basically a core part of their lineup and was like benched for better or worse than if he was a top 50 outfielder. I think it's much more likely that he continues to be pretty good because a lot of the things he's doing well seem choice driven, and it also happens that he's doing some nice things on top of that.
Sure, absolutely. Let's do a real quick hit. We talked about this player last week as well, and as has probably everybody in the industry, and deservedly so. But talk a little bit really, really fast about Kwan.
Okay, I have a spicy take, and I force this into our outline. I wouldn't be shocked if, for Stephen Kwan, is I wouldn't be shocked if he doesn't hit a home run by the end of May.
Spicy, sure. I don't think that it would be all that surprising. That's not his game, right? He might hit 8 all year. So if he doesn't hit his first until after May 31st, I don't know if that's shocking. I guess the question then becomes if he's really a zero almost in home runs from now until May 31st, is he good enough at the things he does well to warrant that spot on your team?
I'm going to get around to my larger concern on that point here in a second. I think the answer's got to be you got to really need the batting average. So Stephen Kwan right now is not hitting the ball hard very often. And that's kind of a thing that I would be concerned about for someone of his profile. Remember when I said at the very top of me looking at hard contact stuff that I was really shocked to see Nick Madrigal had a 45.7% hard contact rate. That is 16 hard hit balls and 35 PAs. Well, our good friend Stephen Kwan also has 37 PAs. True. They both have 37. No, 35 and 37. So same ballpark. Okay. And Kwan has 4 hard hit balls. One of them is a barrel. So he is putting the ball into play often, and it is usually not hit very hard.
Yeah.
he knows what he wants to do, and he seems like his plan is to try to hit it over the shortstop's head, short of the left fielder, or whatever. I guess he's left-handed, so short over the second baseman's head, short of the right fielder. I am not sure that's who he's going to be forever, but right now, that is really concerning. That is, like, 10% hard contact is, like, do not roster material for me personally. That is less than Jorge Mateo, who is bad at baseball. That is less than...
Don't let Mike Kurland hear you.
Mike, hear me out. Bad. That is less than Elvis Andrews, who is... Okay. A bunch of other people. That is bottom 10 right now. He is in the same company as Aristides Aquino, Victor Robles, and Tyler Wade. I would be shocked... Pardon me. I would not be shocked if all of them were homerless before... on May 31st. Just because statistically, I don't expect a lot of these. Wait, did I say Aristides Aquino? I was thinking about someone else, but he is in that company. That's bad. That's separate. I was thinking of that.
Yeah.
Alcides Escobar, who's farther down the list. Okay, he's in the same company as Alcides Escobar.
There you go.
It's the A's names. That's what it is.
I want to push back here just a little bit, because if he's able to garner a batting average while still having a 10% hard contact rate, is it possible he's just one of those rare guys who can do that?
I would not be shocked if he's the sort of guy, here's the other part of it, that can sustain over the course of his career, we'll not know this May 1st, a line drive rate above 30%. That would be unsurprising to me. He got that like Joey Votto-ish skill of knows how to put round object on round object at precisely the right combination to put it in where you want it. Very few people can do that. I wouldn't be terribly...
A line drive doesn't necessarily mean hard contact, right? I just want to clarify.
Right. It's just about the angle. And we think of line drives as those like hit sharply sort of things. Nope. A line drive by a line drive right on Savant includes like some of the flare burner blooper hits that aren't hit very hard, but do get
just
really
launch
good results.
Angle. Yeah, right.
And that's the place that batting average comes from. The ability to do those a lot. It's why Joey Gallo's batting average, in addition to his strikeout rate, is a bit of a liability. He does not get his power to the right part of the park as often as he wants to because he doesn't have the coordination of the bat in a couple different ways. Poor guy. Hope he hits 50 bombs anyway. he can hit the ball not that well and get it over the fence. He's got that much power.
Yeah.
Kwan does not. And that's
right.
That is the point here that I will check back in on later.
So we're not super concerned about his ability to actually maintain a solid batting average. It's just if it's not elite, it's a sacrifice in a lot of other categories that you really may or may not be able to deal with, especially in leagues where replacement value is higher. So those shallower leagues.
Yeah, like that's not even consistently doubles power if he's not hitting those. And that'll hurt his RBI totals, even if he's batting second, which right. means he becomes a runs and average contributor and a sink in enough other categories. Like, he's not going to steal a lot that it's going to be a problem.
Right, right. That makes sense. All right. Let's talk about the obligatory closer content that feels like we have to talk about all the time because it's so fluid. And we'll do it underneath kind of this guise of like what would be surprising if whatever by May 31st. And I'm very interested in what you have to say about this first one, because I think there's an answer, and it's actually a very encouraging answer given where we were in the offseason. But you're talking about the Cincinnati Reds situation, and you have here that no one has more than two saves in Cincinnati. This is as of Tuesday, the 19th. So if somebody picks up an extra one between now and Friday when you're hearing this, obviously that's why, because it's the future for us and the past for you. But what is it that we want to talk about here with the Red situation? Actually, I'm going to say that differently. What is it that you want to say about the Red situation? Because I have a hunch. Go ahead.
The Reds are bad.
Okay.
Okay.
Very clearly stated.
Yeah.
So is this about opportunity, or is this about, or I should say lack of opportunity for the people who are there? Or is this about not really having somebody who has that role?
It's all the above. I'm being a little bit melodramatic here. Two is probably a too low of a bar, but like four maybe is like an actual realistic number. Tony Santian Santillan? Santillan is probably how you should say that. I should look that up. Has won. Art Warren has won. Both of them are probably good pitchers. Lucas Sims is a good pitcher. He's on the IL, should come back. I'm just worried they're not going to generate more than like a handful of save opportunities because they are just really dreadful. And yeah, it's going to be a big problem.
So can I ask this question? And then I'm going to tell you what I was thinking about this. You obviously have to win games to be able to get saves.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Does a team that isn't producing that many runs become more likely to win the games they're going to win by a small enough margin to make up the difference versus a team that is going to win more games, but like the Yankees are going to win a bunch of games by 10, and those aren't save opportunities either?
So the answer is bad teams do generate save opportunities. You're right. It's the makeup of this bad team that's got me a little worried, which is they've got a lot of not good pitchers elsewhere on the team, and they've got a park that's going to generate offense for the other team. I think they could lose a good number of games, like, by a lot, and a lot of their wins then, like, is it gonna, I think those could be on the couple days where people really go off against other teams. I'm worried then that they end up having too many 4-run wins among their wins, where like the other team's pitcher just has a bad day. Okay. Their two wins so far, by the way, they beat Atlanta 6-3. They beat Atlanta 6-3. Those both turns into saves. They've had some really nasty losses in the time since. So, you know, end of May, we're looking at how many save opportunities then. Let's say that they win 30% of their games. They have a save opportunity in 20% of those games. 20% of their games. So 20% of the games is a save opportunity. How many games we got? Let's call that like 40 games. So that's 8 save opportunities. Yeah, if Sims and everyone else divide those equally, it's really possible that no one has more than 3 or 4. 2 is being melodramatic. That's too low. I should have changed that number. But yeah, like less than 5,
you just
I would bet
so
on.
Far. I yeah. thought that when you put that in the notes, I thought you meant to this point.
Oh, no, I mean through the next month.
Over the next month. Well, here's my thought on that. And you can tell me that I'm being stupid, but and maybe it's lack of opportunity. But going into the season, there was kind of this like, who's going to be the closer in Cincinnati? And then Sims got hurt. And this maybe suggests to me that Sims is the guy and they're just waiting for him to be able to come back and do it. But that doesn't change what you're talking about in terms of, well, how many real opportunities, even if he is the bona fide closer, how many real save opportunities is he even going to get?
I also should note that they kind of like to have a guy, but last season they didn't. And or it would change a lot because they were kind of like fickle once they anointed someone the closer and then they were bad for a minute.
Right.
That's a problem. Like, you can say you want a closer and then just not act that way sometimes. And, you know, that park is going to lead to some opportunities for overreacting.
Sure.
I will say.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. I want to move into our off the book segment. We have not honored this segment in a while, and I have something that I want to bring up to you. It, to my mind, this kind of plays into some of the discussions we've had about, like, is bunting good or bad, and how we've kind of solidified the idea that most of the time, if not all the time, bunting is a net negative overall. Or isn't the play, or at least if you compare it to what the alternative is, even when it's successful, it's a very small increase, all of those things that we've talked about. And I want to talk about intentional walks, because I feel like it's sort of similar. And there was a case recently where there was an intentional walk with the bases loaded, which seems on its face to be kind of the opposite of what you're trying to accomplish in a baseball game. So let's talk a little bit about what the math says about intentional walks.
So yeah, this was the Corey Seager being intentionally walked by the Angels with the bases loaded moment. If you say it's on its face kind of weird, it was also on Mike Trout's face a little bit weird. There's a great video of him just like being like confused while he counts the number of like runners on base and being like, hey, what's going on here?
Yeah, right.
Which fair. All of us are kind of there. I should also note before we get too far, because it's the funniest number of all this. Do you know what the record of teams who have intentionally walked with someone with the bases loaded is in the past, like, ever since we've been tracking it?
The number of times a team has done it in a season?
No. Do you know what the win-loss record of teams that have chosen to do it is?
Oh, I'm going to guess it's not good.
They're undefeated with 7 wins.
Really?
It's so stupid.
Okay, well.
Yeah, we go. It has happened to have worked.
I'm undefeated in getting questions that you ask me right. I'm only defeated, I should say. So it's worked. So, okay. So what does the math say? Is the math saying, like, this is pure genius and it's one of those things that flies in the face of, like, we're trying to keep that other team from scoring runs, but we're going to give them a run right now? Or is this just coincidence? I it's hard for me to kind of wrap my head around this. Let's talk about this situation. Let's talk about the bases loaded, because that's what we're on. And then let's segue into just intentional walks in general, because putting runners on base, I have to imagine mathematically, increases run potential for the other team. But there's got to be a counter argument in terms of, like, well, the batter who gets walked is more likely to put the ball in play and all of that. That's the balance, right?
So basically the math that you're mentally doing there is, which is worse, giving a team a run and changing the batter from Corey Seager to someone else, or letting Corey Seager hit? So is Corey Seager a full run on average better than the person behind him? Because notably, if you walk someone with the base, if the bases are loaded and you're, say, up by 3, you're worried about giving up a grand slam, right? Well, if you walk someone with the bases loaded, a double now gives up the lead. So you have to think that the odds of the person at bat hitting a home run are higher than the odds of the next person at bat hitting anything better than a single. That's basically, like, the rough math there. Like, you assume that on a double, the runner scores from first. Maybe you got Pujols there, et cetera, et cetera. But even then, you don't want to walk, because suddenly Pujols... Well, actually, pardon me, let's change that. Let's say Pujols is at bat. You get a lefty on the hill. You can't change the pitcher. And you're like, okay, he actually could hit a home run. But if we intentionally walk him, he's really slow and he'll be on first. I'm using him because he just comes to mind because he's really slow and I made the situation work for him. Whatever. But, like, that's basically the situation you have to imagine. Pujols is in the game. The guy behind him is really bad, has no power, and you're up exactly 3 runs, and you have, like, none out or something like that, like 1 out, and you're like, the double play won't help me or something like that. Like, even then, like, that's the situation you imagine for yourself, right?
Sure.
Well, the nice thing is, our friends at FanGraphs, Ben Clemens, wrote this nice piece detailing a lot of that actual work. There's some other people who have, like, he wrote it up in really nice and, like, easy to read form. I really suggest it. But, like, I've seen some other people, I think Baseball Prospectus did it. Someone else has done it as well, that basically says, I know where I saw this. Tom Tango pulled this for whenever he was, like, working with a team in early 2000s, and there was, like, a Bonds chart, should you walk a guy in a certain case? And, like, he showed it on his Twitter, like, when should you do it? And basically the answer is, like, never, never, ever, ever, ever should you walk someone with the bases loaded. It is always because of that thing we said about homers and doubles, a stupid idea. So,
except the teams are 7-0 when they've done it.
Yeah, isn't math fun? Stupid teams win some games sometimes. I love it as a quirk. Remember, they're all winning, though, right? Like, it's a bad idea because it reduces your chance of winning, but they were all winning the game when they did it.
Yeah, so let's say if their win outcome going into that inning was 80%, and they reduce it down to 68% by doing this, they still have a higher likelihood of winning the game. That makes sense.
Yeah. So you can explain the quirk of everything there.
So it's more like getting away with doing something dumb, but but is it dumb if it works every time? I don't know. It's 60% of the time it works every time. What about just intentional walks in general? Is there math to support it being the right idea, or at the very least bring us through the logic like you did with the bases loaded? So there's a guy on second and a thumper up. we're going to walk him because that increases, I would assume, the out potential of a batted ball by the next player, right? That's
right,
kind of
yeah.
where we're at.
Intentionally walking a batter whenever a first base is open and there's a runner on second, I think is a reasonable idea. It's the obvious thing to do, by the way, if you're in the bottom of the ninth and you have one out and you are leading by one. You should almost always be willing to intentionally walk in some of those cases, unless like the person that you would be bringing up will be better. There were some interesting ways that we got to see that expressed whenever teams first started experimenting with the runner on second in the extras rule. I remember the Astros being in some situations where they had like Bregman and Altuve or Bregman and someone else up as like the two batters, and they chose to attack Altuve and then intentionally walk Bregman second once they had an out.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that question. So intentionally walking the first batter is probably not great because now you've got two on and nobody out, right? But once you have that out, now you're increasing the opportunity for a double play to get you out of the inning.
The thing is, if the ball game's tied, it doesn't matter. The runner on second scores, the game's over regardless. It's just a matter of who do you think you're more likely to get out, the first or
only
the second batter.
Only if it's the top. Only if the home team is hitting, though, right? So that's
right,
not all...
and that's the case that was happening in these cases.
In that particular, game. Okay, so, yeah, it's fascinating to me, all of these different things. I always kind of thought of bunting before we talked about it as, that's a smart move. You get that guy into scoring position and you need that run. It's an improvement. It's a smart move. And then you look at what the math says about the potential outcomes and the likelihood and all of that. And turns out that's not the case. So I thought that bringing up, especially in light of this particular situation and the look on Mike Trout's face, it would be a fun thing to explore and discuss.
Yeah, there's a fun thing that happens in baseball in that, like, outside of the couple of weird things where someone's been intentionally walked with the bases loaded, we actually have just an insane amount of data about like every other situation that's happened. We know how many runs you should expect if you have a runner on second and nobody out, or a runner on first and second and nobody out, or, make the contrived situation with bunting however you want to build it. We know how many runs you'd expect to give up, and we know what the odds of the runner scoring are. You can adjust those slightly based off of who's pitching and batting. Teams have that data. Smart teams are making a, like, here's what we'd expect thing. And in a lot of those ranges, it's a go with your gut situation once you get down to, like, they're both the same thing. A good manager's gut is based off of knowing their player's confidence and being able to manage all of the intangibles. And, like, there is definitely statistical room for that sort of stuff. You want to make sure that you don't go with your gut.
Stats aren't giving you a 100% outcome, right? And even if it's the humanity that lives in a 10%, it's still a chance.
Right.
That's why things that are supposed to happen don't always happen.
Right. You want to make sure your manager is not choosing to go with his gut when it's an obviously wrong choice, where it's like, no, like, this is going to fail 90% of the time, don't do it. But if we're like in the 40 to 60 range with error bars, I hope you can trust who's down there. I hope that the person in the dugout is someone you believe in.
Now, you don't really want somebody who's going to make, on the macro, I would imagine, over the course of a year, even if it's 60-40, if they're constantly going against the math, they're making that more 50-50, right? By the choices that they're making, they're changing the calculus there. So it's, I don't know. I think it's very interesting to me and very fascinating for somebody whose brain doesn't work around numbers the way that yours does. That's the sort of thing where, like, we talk about these probability outcomes, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing that's about to happen in this moment doesn't care about your math. It's going to be either this or that, right?
It's also probably never going to happen again and has never happened before. There's been an infinite number of bases loaded situations, but there has never been the bases loaded on April 22nd with
the wind blowing one way, the shadows, batter hitters, how did they play extra innings last night? There's the idea there being that there are so many variables in the course of a baseball game, and comparing one situation to the next, that gives you enough wiggle room to be able to say, well, in this situation, I think that this is the move. Fascinating stuff. Absolutely fascinating. Thank you, as always, Alexander, for being a part of this and joining me on this podcast. And if you could just remind the people where they can find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at TheCorkedMatt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.